Okay. So, you watched both videos about the Abbey, and I thought, you know, that this evening would be more kind of a Q&A session, because I want to know, like, what your thoughts are, what your questions are, what you want to know about Sangha in the West, because otherwise I could just go on and on and on. But, you know, I think you may have specific things that are important to you that you want to know. So we start off. Anybody have questions? Also going to be a very lively evening.
Venerable, from when you ordained until now, I'm sure you have seen changes in monastics in the West, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on what it was like in the 70s and now the opportunities.
Okay, so kind of the changes from then until now. Okay, so I was probably, you know, one of the people in the first generation who are ordained in the Tibetan tradition. There were some people who were ordained before me, but we were all kind of within that first generation. And so all of us, I would say, or most of us, met the Dharma in Asia. I happen to actually have met the lamas in the U.S., but because there were no Dharma centers, then I went to Asia. So, you know, all of us lived in Asia, trained in Asia. So we had the real experience of living with the Tibetan community, which was, you know, that was much closer to the time they came out into exile. They were really quite impoverished at that time. India was also much poorer at that time. But we lived in the community. There were difficulties, you know. When I look at the training I had in the early years and how people live now, I mean, life always have difficulties, but there were special things we confronted. You know, a lot of us had health problems. People got sick. We had visa problems. We would stay at Copan until, you know, the Nepali government decided that we had to leave next week, that the foreigners had been there too long. So there were visa problems. There weren't very many lamas who spoke English, and there weren't very many good translators either. So it was, and there weren't very many books. I mean, now there's, like, you know, there's Buddhist publishers and there's so many books. At that time, at Copan, we had this book, The Wish Fulfilling Golden Sun, you know, this old mimeographed one. And that was kind of it, besides the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which nobody understands very well. And Lobsang Rampa, who was an Irish plumber who made up most of the stuff he wrote about. You know, so we weren't able to learn too much from, you know, reliable sources in English, you know. So that was difficult. The Westerners, some of us had financial problems. Some people were supported by their family, but while the Tibetan lamas ordained us, like I said, the Tibetan community was much poorer, so their priority was the Tibetan monks, and to some extent the nuns. The nuns were always down there. So that was their priorities, and since we were from the West, it was assumed that we were wealthy, when with some of us that was not the case at all. We weren't really able to, I mean, we could live at Copan, we lived separately, but even in the rest of India, we really weren't able to live in the Tibetan monasteries. I mean, there was, you know, visa problem and health problem and language problem and all of that kind of stuff. So very often we were on our own, and there weren't really Dharma centers when I started out. They were just beginning to start. So, you know, we had to move around according to, you know, the which country would give us a visa. We used to joke that the at that time, if you were a British citizen, you didn't have to have a visa to stay in India. Now they do, but at that time you didn't. So we used to joke that that was the 11th quality of a precious human life. You know, being a Brit so you could have a visa so you could stay there. Yeah. But there was something so precious about that time, and something that I think was extremely valuable in going through the hardship. You know, very, very valuable. Because you really had to want to be there, you really had to want to learn the Dharma. Yeah. And I think sometimes when things come very easy, we don't appreciate them. So most of us who stayed there and had to deal with India in those days, we really appreciated the Dharma. We appreciated what we were receiving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, since then, things have changed a lot. Now there's a lot of Dharma centers in the West, and India itself is much richer. The Tibetans are much richer. In the old days, those of you who've been to Dharamsala, you know, I mean, there's the mountain. And the old days, if you were walking from the library up to McLeod, if you saw one car, it was astounding. And you knew it must be somebody who was really rich and really important. Now there are taxis just zooming up and down the mountain all the time. Yeah. Before, forget about telephones, you know? Because, I mean, I went there, the first time I went to India was 73. I wasn't a Buddhist at that time. Then I went back to Nepal in 75. But still, you know, just the situation there was so much different than now. Yeah. So now there's Dharma centers. And, yeah, and people meet Dharma in the West. And so, yeah, I think it's very different than my generation living in Asia and going through what we did. I think it was different. I'm not being very articulate, am I? But, you know, it was quite different. And then, you know, once Dharma centers started getting set up, then things really changed and more people came. But in terms of monastics, it still was difficult because there weren't monasteries, so we stayed in Dharma centers, but the Dharma centers are geared towards the lay people. Yeah. And then many of us didn't have money, so, you know, we worked at the Dharma centers, so we cleaned the lay people's toilets or cooked their food or did that kind of thing. So it was a situation where the Sangha wasn't, you know, didn't have the role that they usually have and weren't treated like they were Sangha so much. We were charged to go to teachings. And for people who had money from their families, that was okay. For the rest of us, it was really difficult. Yeah, so some of that has changed now. But some of it hasn't. Maybe we should go on to the next question. But see, all of this, a lot of this is one of the reasons why I set up the Abbey, is because I thought, you know, we should be able to do this in a better way. And Sangha should be able to live as Sangha and have a place that is organized around what their needs and concerns are, you know, and a place where they don't have to pay, where they don't have to worry about money. Yeah, because it's very difficult to keep your vows if you, you know, have to go get a job and, you know, do all that kind of stuff.
You hinted at the inequalities between how monks and nuns are treated.
Oh, you're so polite.
And that can be very difficult for Western women to hear. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The Tibetans will tell you there is no gender discrimination. There is none, you know. But, you know, that's because you know, because when you're in the majority, you don't see the prejudice and the bias. It's, you know, so they'll say there's no gender discrimination. But a friend of mine from Wisconsin is studying at the IBD, the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics, and with the young monks. And not, I mean, they're adults, but young adults. And he said one day his teacher asked him, this is just a few years ago, not in the old days. His teacher asked the class, how many of you think that kind of men are more intelligent and better off than women? And all the young monks raised their hands, you know. But there's no gender discrimination. Yeah, it's an interesting situation. And as a woman, if you bring something up, you are told that you are, you know, it's like here, you know, you're aggressive, you're demanding, you're impolite, et cetera, et cetera. And especially in that kind of context, they feel like, well, Buddhism is ours and it's not yours, so you shouldn't be telling us how to do things. So getting angry or doing anything like that just doesn't work in that kind of situation. I feel here in the West, it's very different, and it's very important that we set up Buddhism on a gender equal basis here in the West. Otherwise, it's not going to survive here. People just won't have it. Yeah, and so I think that, like in translations, we should make translations gender equal, not son of the, you know, son of the lineage, yeah, child of the lineage. I think we should have gender equal translations. The issue of ordination is a touchy one because they don't have the lineage for full ordination in Tibetan Buddhism. So, for example, I went to Taiwan to take the full ordination. So there's that. But I think in the West we have much more space to make things equal. And I think it's very important for Westerners, and especially men in the West, to raise the question when things are slipping by, you know, not angry, very polite, but, you know, how come this and this and this, yeah, and really let the teachers know that for us gender equality is very important. Yeah. In terms of, you know, whatever comments you find in the scriptures or whatever, in my mind, those are due to culture at that time. Yeah. It's hard to say. I mean, because you know, sometimes people have biases, and you can't always address them. you know, especially if somebody's your teacher. Yeah, it's more difficult. But in a teaching setting, if questions are asked, then that's a very good way to address those things. But I think at the Abbey, we just said everybody's, you know, there's gender equality, except the guys get to carry the heavy things. You know? And that's just the way we do it. And so I think, you know, in the West we have that space. It can be more jarring or difficult, I think, on the lamas, because they grew up in an all-male environment and they don't really sometimes know how to relate to women. And also, I think sometimes, to be honest, Western women don't take into account that they're working with celibate monks, and they should dress appropriately and not come to offer a kata with a plunging neckline like this, you know? So I think there needs to be more respect for the celibacy vows. But also, on the other hand, more respect for women's ability and capability. His Holiness has been quite instrumental in changing that for the Tibetan community. When I first came there, the nuns got very little education. And actually now, this month, the Tibetan nuns are taking the first round of Geshima exams, which is a huge thing. So we will have some female Geshe soon, which will be very, very nice. But it's also an interesting situation because the Tibetan nuns don't have a lot of confidence. They stay in the background. You raise that way, and I know that because I lived in the community. That just the message you get is, you know, sit in the back, be quiet, you know, be kind of shy and like this. And that was always really difficult for me. Yeah. I mean, when you grow up in the West and you have an education, you have a job, and, you know, you're not like this. So, yeah. So, you know, there's definitely a difference, I think, between the Western women and the Tibetan nuns. The Tibetan women in general, sometimes, I mean, they'll run the shops and things like that, but religion, whatever religion it is always the last thing to change. I mean, religion always talks about equality and love and compassion and fairness and progress, and it's the last institution to change when it comes to racism, sexism, homophobia, and the whole nine yards. It's strange, isn't it? Isn't it strange? Uh-huh. So that's the situation it is. But I don't think, I just had to learn not to take any of this stuff to heart. I mean, I lived in Asia a long time. When I came back here, I realized how much I had lost a lot of self-confidence just by living in that community with the unspoken messages. And it took me a while to regain my self-confidence. Yeah. They're from the different nunneries. Okay. Some are from Janchum Chuling, Jamyang Chuling, Gaydon Chuling, the Kapan Nunnery, Kachu Gyakye. No, that's another one. Anyway, yeah, so there's a few different ones, and they're coming to Dharamsala to do it. Yeah. Yeah, and the nuns are now debating. They're studying the philosophical topics and so on. So it's really wonderful. One of the things that made the difficulty in them getting the Geshima, being able to take the exams, is that the monks said to take the exams, you have to study Vinaya. And you can only study Vinaya completely when you're fully ordained. And sorry, nuns, there's no lineage for you to become fully ordained now. So because you can't become a bhikshuni, then you can't become a geshi. But then His Holiness just kind of kept after them. So now they've changed it so that the nuns study, they can study what they're capable of. You know, they could always study, you know, what they're capable of being at somas, but they made the Vinaya exam for the geshima according to what the nuns are permitted to study. Yeah, so that's good. They're not going to be La Rampa Geshis because you have to study the whole Vinaya to do that. But they are getting Geshima degrees, which is going to be quite wonderful. Do you feel okay about my answer?
I still find challenges with it and have questioned how that came about. Like, how that relates to, as you said, the ideas of the Buddha being equal. And
well, the thing that I've come to the conclusion of is, I mean, the Dharma is pure and faultless, and that's what we take refuge in, is the three jewels. Religious institutions are created by human beings, and human beings have mental afflictions. So religious institutions are not going to always coincide with what, you know, the teachers have taught, because they're formed by afflicted, you know, human beings. Yeah. But I'll tell you one experience I had. Sitting in Dharamsala, because I would go to the spring teachings and, you know, all the monks and nuns are there. And there was would always be a tsoka offering at the end of the teachings. And the monks always got up and made the tsoka offering to His Holiness. Never the nuns. Never, ever the nuns. Always the monks. And then the monks would pass out the tsoka to everybody in the audience. And I remember sitting there one time, just kind of going, well, look at this. The monks get to offer the soak to His Holiness. The monks get to pass it out to everybody. The nuns can't do anything. We just have to sit here. And then I thought, but if the nuns offered the soak to His Holiness, and then the nuns had, you know, passed out the offerings to everybody, then I would say, oh, look, they make the nuns stand up and do all the work, and the monks just sit there. So when I realized that, you know, there was a big shift in my mind, because, yeah. Other questions? I mean, it comes down to, you have to believe in yourself. And you know what was a big changing point for me in this? Is in 93, there was a conference of Western Buddhist teachers with His Holiness. And it was in the context of the presentation about monastic life that we made to His Holiness. And he said to us, you go ahead and start monasteries and do things. And if you run into trouble, then come talk to me and talk to us. And for me, that was like, whoa, somebody opened the door and just said, go and do it. And somebody no less than His Holiness. And so it really showed me that, yeah, you know, when you believe in yourself, you just go and do it. And, you know, part of the difficulty is when we're timid and shy and we don't believe in ourselves. Yeah. So I'm not talking about being brazen and inconsiderate and rebellious and, you know, because that's not going to work. That's stupid. Yeah. But, you know, kind of saying, oh, I can learn the teachings, I can meditate, I can do practice, I can do these things, and not let somebody else kind of tell you what your role or position is. Mm-hmm. Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What are some of your current goals for the monastery and for the community?
Mm. Well, one of my long-term goals, I mean, my big prayer is may the Abbey become a beacon of the Dharma for the whole world. And I pray that Jay Rinpoche be born there. Yeah, that he take rebirth there and be like he was in Tibet and really clarify things and teach the pure Dharma and get everybody going on the right track again. And why not pray for Jay Rinpoche to be born at the Abbey? Why not? Yeah? Mm-hmm. I think it would be fantastic. So, you know, so please. Yeah? And, you know, I mean, that's my prayer, my aspiration, that, you know, it be a place where the Buddha's pure teachings exist forever. And when people say the Abbey's supposed to exist, somebody once said 300 years. I said, that's not long enough. They said 1,000. I said, that's still not long enough. You know, it's like until samsara ends. And, and one thing that I think that I really would like to do, well, we're still a ways from doing that, is you know, because we follow the Vinaya tradition practiced in Taiwan, where there are fully ordained nuns, okay, and to give the full ordination for nuns, that novice ordination can be done by nuns, but the full ordination you need monks and nuns. And what I would like to have happen sometime is where we can give that ordination in English at our monastery. Yeah. Now we do the novice ordination, the novice and training ordinations, and the ceremonies are in English. And it's beautiful doing the ceremony when you understand what you're doing. Yeah. And we just do it slowly and in English. We rehearse it beforehand so that people know what's going on and how they're supposed to think. But I would like to be able to do the full ordination for both men and women. Yeah. But to do that, you need people who have been ordained long enough to be able to be the preceptors. So we don't have the monks yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right now we have 9 nuns at the Abbey. Yeah. But, you know, I want to have... And also, one thing that's very important is we're not trying to recreate a Tibetan monastery because we're not Tibetans. And, you know, right now at this time, the Tibetans are the lineage holders because the scriptures are in their language. And not all the Westerners are going to learn Tibetan. But what I feel is really important is that we emphasize thought transformation. So I really like the name of your center, the Kadampa Center, because I admire very much the Kadampa Geshe's and how they were so focused on really training the mind, not just on intellectual knowledge, but really training the mind and transforming the mind. And so that's something that we emphasize a lot in what we do. Yeah.
I have one for you.
Mm-hmm.
In watching the movie, I was just so moved by seeing how everyone got along and, you know, worked together. But what would a typical day look like?
Well, our daily schedule, and everybody participates in the daily schedule. If you're a guest, it doesn't matter who you are. Unless you're sick, you do the daily schedule. Yeah. So this is something for people to get used to because at the beginning, you know, it's sometimes difficult. So we have meditation from 5:30 until 7 in the morning. Then 7:30 there's breakfast. 8:15 we have a stand-up meeting. We all kind of check in with each other. And then we begin our offering service period. Offering service is what other people call work. But we call it offering service because that's indicative of the mental transformation that we want to make. We're not working. We are offering service to sentient beings. So that goes until noon. We have prayers, you know, but when we sit down to eat breakfast, we do some chanting, and the meal's taken in silence. Same with lunch. Right before lunch, we have a short Dharma talk. Then we do some chanting. We have lunch in silence. Then we do some more chanting at the end of lunch. Then there's a break until 2 o'clock. There's more offering service. And then from 4:30 until 6, we have either teachings or discussion or personal study. 6 is medicine meal. 7 is meditation. And that goes till 8:15. And then people are usually worn out, but many people stay up and read or do something else after the last meditation session. Yeah. And we really emphasize community life as part of our practice. Yeah. So we function as a community. In other words, the Abbey isn't a place where people just go to study, you know, because there's many places where people will go there when there's the study program, and then when there's a break in the study program, then they go somewhere else. That's not the case with us. With us, this is our home, and we live there, and we function as a community. And if somebody wants to go away, then they check with the whole community. Is this a good time? Is it convenient for everybody? And so on. So, yeah, so it's our life is lived very much with consideration for the other people that we're living with, and a spirit of community life, and not just, well, what's good for my practice, and what do I feel like doing, and what's convenient for me. Yeah, we really try and get over that kind of self-centeredness. So it can be challenging for people. I don't feel like going to meditation practice this morning. Well, that's nice. We'll see you there. Yeah? You know, because one of our big enemies is I want what I want when I want it. Yeah? And if we're really serious about transforming our mind, that's the big one we got to deal with. Yeah, so following a daily schedule and living as a community puts us in that situation. Yeah, they often describe it as rocks in a tumbler, and we chip off each other's rough edges. Yeah, but you know the way we do community, we're very close knit, and people have to learn to be transparent. You know, if people want to hide, it doesn't work in our community. In some communities you can hide and you can be very private and all. But the way we do things, because I think transparency is important, because when we have a spirit of transparency, then we can admit our faults without feeling ashamed of things. Yeah? And I think that's something very important for us as Westerners to be able to do. Because people have so much difficulty, you know, so much self-hatred and so on. But to be able to just say I made a mistake, confess our fault, the whole community knows anyway. Yeah? So trying to pretend we're goody two-shoes is not going to work. And so just being honest, and then, you know, sometimes asking the community for help. You know, I'm having problems with anger this week. Kind of beware, but also help me. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. What is the ratio of,
hold on 1 second.
Remaining sangha, or how many disrobe and go back to lay?
Yeah, you know, I don't have any statistics about that.
Just curious.
I mean, I know that a lot of people disrobe, both Tibetans and Westerners. Yeah. Yeah. In the Tibetan case, see, the Tibetans have the philosophy that it is better to be ordained one day in this degenerate age rather than your whole lifetime at the time of the Buddha. So they really, you know, like new people come from Tibet, they'll go right into the monasteries and all. And so sometimes the Tibetans will disrobe when, you know, their families want them to go out and work and to earn money. Or they'll come here. You know, they're all trying to get here. And then so many of them disrobe because they would much rather work washing dishes in New York and earn some money, you know, than stay in their robes and study in India. And when I meet them, I'm like, don't you realize what a good situation you have? You don't have problems with Tibetan. You can talk to the lamas in your own language. You're in a huge monastery. Why do you want to wash dishes in New York? Yeah. Well, it's because, you know, the Dharma hasn't been integrated, so the motivation isn't there. In the case of Westerners, there's also many who disrobe. And I would say for Westerners, it's usually because they want to be in a couple relationship. You know, not always, but very often. I would say that would be the predominant one. That you have to ask them. I am not sorry at all that you cannot ask me that question. The men can, the women can't. Well, the men can take full ordination up to 7 times. The women can take the novice. There's some discussion, but it seems like the women can take the novice ordination again, which in the Tibetan tradition is what they have for women. But full ordination a woman can take only one time. Yeah? So if you give it back, then that's it. Yeah? But sometimes being stricter makes us stronger. Makes us more careful. Yeah?
You mentioned anger, and that made me think of what makes me angry. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you have a lot of exposure to politics and the outside world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we read the news, and I was telling you we have these little Dharma talks right before lunch every day. We call them Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner. We started giving them before breakfast, then we moved it to lunch, but we kept the title. But a lot of times when there's, you know, strong things happening in the news, then our Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner will be about that. Yeah, so we have lots of videos on YouTube. And I think there's different playlists, but we spoke about the Boston bombings. We spoke about Newtown. You know, a lot of things about gun control. That's one of my passions. So whenever there's something quite big in the news, because we know people get very distressed, and we want to be able to offer them a Dharma perspective on how to live. How to look at current events. Yeah. Yeah.
You said there were 9 nuns there, and I was just curious, what is your selection process? Do you have a waiting list? It would, you know, it's...
Oh, okay. Our selection
in the country and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So we have 9 nuns. We have one female 8 precept person who's preparing for ordination, and then one man who's 8 precept. We are very careful who we take in, because many years ago I lived at in a monastery in France, and we had to take in everybody who the lamas ordained. I said, I am never doing that again. you know, because we weren't able to, we had to live with them. The lamas ordained them. We had no power for selection, and we had to live with them, and that didn't work. Also, my philosophy is a little bit different than the Tibetans' philosophy. Like I said, they think, you know, one day in this degenerate age is great. And I'm looking at it from the perspective of Buddhism is new to America, so people need to be properly prepared before they're ordained. They need to be properly trained after they're ordained so that the lay community can develop respect for the Sangha. If people aren't prepared, if they aren't trained, and then you have people with mental health difficulties, then the rest of the populace loses faith in the Sangha, and that's not good for the existence of the Dharma in the West. So that's my viewpoint. So, we have, when people come just for a short retreat, we have a short form to register. But when they come for a longer period of time, then we have quite an extensive application. Because we also want to know about their Dharma background, you know, because that makes a difference on how you help them, you know. If they've studied in another tradition before, they're going to come in with certain expectations, so we want to be able to address those and so on. We want to know about their health, their work experience, all these kinds of things, you know. We ask for references, and sometimes, you know, we do that. We ask them if they, you know, drink and drug, and if they're willing to abstain. So it's kind of a fairly complete thing. If there's any questions, then our office manager will call the person and kind of talk with them. And then, you know, some people come just to stay with us for a short time, some for a course, some just to take part in the daily schedule. So we have lay people coming all the time for many, many different periods of time. So you're all quite welcome to come and stay with us. For the people who want to really, you know, who are thinking about ordination, then we have a course, which she attended, called Exploring Monastic Life. It's 2.5 weeks every August. So we have people come to that. We ask them to keep the 5 precepts for a while. Then when they come to the Abbey, when they're ready, they can request the 8 precepts, so which is not a monastic ordination. But we have them wear a little, well, not little, some of them are pretty big, blue suit, or sometimes gray suits, you saw them, yeah? And they shave their heads, so they're 8 precept holders. So those are people who are, you know, seeing if perhaps this is what they want to do. And I believe this year of kind of trying it out is very, very helpful, because many people go on and they get ordained, and then some people say, you know, I realize this really isn't for me. And I tell them, then you've had a very successful 1 year training period, because you've learned something very important about your life, and you've cleared up this kind of doubt about should I ordain or shouldn't I ordain. And now you can practice as a lay person and be a good lay practitioner. Yeah? So I feel that 1 year is really, really helpful for people. Then they take the novice ordination, and they, both men and women, keep that for 2 years, and then to take the full ordination. So right now, all of our novice ordinations have been given at the Abbey, and then the full ordinations, they go to Taiwan and take it. In fact, one of our nuns is there right now, and she's coming back on Saturday, and she'll be coming back as a bhikshuni, so that's something we're all very excited about. Yeah. So we have now enough fully ordained nuns where we can do the fortnightly confession and restoration of precept ceremony. So in order to do that ceremony, you need 4 or more fully ordained people. So with this nun coming back, she'll be our 7th. So we, you know, and this ceremony that we do every 2 weeks of confessing and restoring our precepts is very important, and we have enough people to do that, so we do that regularly. And, yeah.
What's in Taiwan?
Oh, what's in Taiwan? Because there's enough monks and nuns there to give the full ordination. And like I said, they don't have the full ordination for women in the Tibetan tradition. So, for example, like me, I took my novice ordination in the Tibetan tradition, but then to do my full ordination, I went to Taiwan. There's been a lot of discussion in the Tibetan community about, is there a way to begin or reinstitute the full ordination for women? Yeah, and there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of research. They still haven't come to a conclusion. But, you know, so some of us, I mean, I went many years ago to Taiwan to do it. Some people are kind of, well, let's wait and see what the Tibetans decide. So people make their own choice about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it would only really enhance the Dharma in the Tibetan community to have fully ordained nuns, because the nuns can do so much. Can't they, Robbie? Yes, good, good. Okay. Any other questions? Or questions people may have? Yeah. Uh huh.
Are there nuns who are they able to, after they ordain or go to live at the abbey, maintain a kind of a close relationship with families, or do they have to kind of separate themselves from that in order to not engage in idle talk and that sort of thing?
Right. Okay. So the relationship with our families. Actually, the novice ordination, not even the full ordination, but the novice ordination is called, the literal translation is going forth. So you're going forth from home into homelessness. So that pertains in terms of, you know, your living situation and in terms of your relationship with your family. So what we do is, you know, people can call their families and so on. We have a little thing, you know, kind of how often and how long they can talk to them. They can go visit. People can leave the abbey for up to two weeks every year. But we really kind of see things on a very individual basis. You know, some people are very, very attached to their families, and that can become an obstacle in their ordination when there's a lot of emotional attachment. So with those people, we really try and help them to see that, yes, you love your family, but as a monastic, the way you relate to your family is different, you know, because normally we're quite attached to our family. We favor family members over other people. So that leads to, you know, friends, enemies, strangers, attachment, aversion, and apathy. And so we really try and get people to work on developing equanimity across the board for all living beings. Okay? But, you know, of course they see their family and you know, one of our nuns, her parents are quite sick, so sometimes she goes there, you know, if her sister's usually helping to care for them, but if her sister has to go away, then she'll go there for a short while, a week or so, to take care. I go and visit my father, who's quite old, and yeah. But we really, the thing is, if you're in a monastery, your mind has to be in the monastery. Yeah. If your body's in the monastery but your mind is with your family, you're not going to be real happy. Yeah? And so we really try and get people to, you know, and we try and do this before they ordain. Yeah. Yeah. So that's when it all comes up. Oh, you won't let me see my family. Well, you decided you wanted to try this out. We're trying to help you try it out. You know, this is part of it. See if this is really for you or not. Yeah, if you're really, really attached to your family, maybe you want to go back and live with your family. Yeah.
Hi. I'm going to ask you a question that I would have a little bit of a hard time asking our Sangha here because they're going to be so modest in how they answer it. Are there things that we can do or things that you would advise us to do that can help our Sangha here?
That is a beautiful question. I applaud you for asking that. Really. No, really, truly, because so often in Dharma centers, people see the Sangha as unpaid labor, you know? And your Sangha, okay, everything there is to do in the center, we just give to you and we don't have to pay you. You know? And that's not the way the relationship the Buddha set up between the laity and the Sangha. So I really appreciate your question. Thank you very much. Yeah? So I've only been here a week. I haven't seen all your inner goings on. Yeah, I only see people when they're sitting here and they all looked very nice and sweet and proper, everything like that. Yeah. I think, you know, I think just to remember that people have precepts and to help them keep their precepts, you know. So don't invite them out to movies. Don't invite them to parties and weddings. Yeah? Kind of, you know, help them with that. Don't invite them to the beach party to wear their latest maroon bikini. You know? that's not what we do. Okay? And, you know, give them the time to study. Because one of the things that comes up is like, well, we need Westerners who are very learned, and we need Westerners with realizations. But the thing is, people aren't born learned, and they aren't born with realizations. So they need time to train and time to be, receive an education, time to meditate. Yeah, time to do the monastic rituals. So as much as you can help them, you know, in the way to support them financially so that they can really do what we ordained to do. Yeah. That doesn't mean we don't work. I mean, they're working a lot here around the center. And that's the kind of work that the Sangha should do. And, you know, and learn the Dharma and be able to give spiritual counseling and so on and spiritual guidance and lead meditation sessions and give Dharma talks and go out and give talks in public schools when people, you know, need to learn. And, you know, I went this afternoon to the prison and, you know, Chukyi's doing a wonderful job there. But, you know, really to support them and so that they can do what ordained beings got ordained to do. Yeah. So I don't really know how it's organized now, but that's just, I would say, a general guideline. And if circumstances come together at some time and it feels comfortable to everybody involved, it would be very nice to have a community. Yeah, where people live together. Because it really makes a difference when you can live with other Sangha. Makes a big difference. Thank you for your question. Is there things I should add to that? Do people have more specific anything about that? Do you have anything more? You can whisper in my ear what I should tell them.
Do they feel supported?
Yeah. The Buddha set up the way the relationship is to be. You know, when people went forth from the home life into the homeless life, you know, in ancient times they would be wanderers, basically, and then they began to become more settled down after some time. People offered land and so monasteries began and so on. But the relationship was always that the laity supported the Sangha, and then the Sangha, you know, studied and practiced and taught the Dharma and shared the Dharma. The monasteries were the place where you had a physical place where you knew the Dharma was being preserved. No? And that's quite special, I think. So it would be good in the U.S. if we could do that. Yeah, I know there's many lay teachers and many excellent lay practitioners, but, you know, you wouldn't look at somebody's house with their, you know, spouse and kids as the place where the Dharma is going to get preserved. Okay? So, you know, at the Abbey, one of the ways that we try and keep this, you know, because the old tradition, the monastics went on alms. And nowadays, we have some friends in California, a monastery that does that. They have to get a parade permit in their town. Because you have a line of monastics, so you need a parade permit. So, you know, we haven't gone on Pindapat yet in our little town. But the way we try and do it is that we don't buy food. You know, we eat only the food that's offered to us. And so that sets up a special kind of relationship and a special kind of mentality, because there's something so raw about food, you know, and sharing food and giving somebody the food they need to sustain their lives and receiving that food from other people who you know work very hard at their jobs, you know, to be able to give you food, and you just feel their kindness in supporting you, and so wanting to live up to being worthy of their offerings. So that does something to your mind in terms of helping you to see the kindness of others and getting your act together. So that's how we do it. So, like at the Abbey, we don't charge for everything. We don't charge for everything. We don't charge for anything. And I really appreciate that it, here too, you don't charge. You know, I think that's so important. Dharma's for everybody, and then everybody is generous according to their own ability and their own heart. Yeah, so I really respect and thank you for doing things that way. Very important. Other questions? You're all going to line up afterwards to ask. Okay. Then I guess that's it. So I've enjoyed my time here very much. Don and I were talking, and I came first in 96, you think? 95? When was, what? In 89? Yeah, it might have been 90 or 91, yeah. And then, you know, so haven't, you know, come back kind of with big gaps of time in between, but have really been able to see the growth in the center. And it's quite wonderful what you have going here, and people seem very harmonious, which is extremely important. you know? Because if people aren't harmonious, then nobody even wants to come here. Yeah? So, but you know, you feel like a very harmonious group, and things are well organized too. And people really seem to care about the center. I heard about how you all pitched in to paint the place and, you know, redo everything. So that's quite wonderful, because then you all have a feeling of ownership, in the sense of, you know, this is my Dharma center and I care about it and I want to make it available so that other people can come and meet the Buddha's precious teachings too. Yeah. And you have a really wonderful teacher. Geshe-la is fantastic. So please don't take him for granted, you know. To have a Geshe here and somebody with his kind of personality and approachability is quite special. And so whenever you have the opportunity to receive teachings, come and receive teachings. Don't think, well, Geshe-la's always here, so I don't feel like going this week because my little toe hurts, so I'll go next week. Yeah, forget your little toe. It's more important that you come for teachings. Yeah, so really take advantage while you have the opportunity. It's very important. Yeah, and what you're doing for the kids is very cute. Yeah, so you should all see if your kids can sit, you know, in the Vajra position. Yeah. And get him to do 3 breaths, you know, just 3 breaths quietly. That's good for them as a start. Okay. So thank you very much. You're all welcome to come out west and sit with us as well.
Well, Venerable Tendrin, on behalf of all the members of the center, I think Venerable Tendrin off in Australia. I was just thinking how nice it could be if she would be here, one of our other Sangha members.
Yes.
Venerable Thubten Chodron, on behalf of all the members of Kadampa Center, those who are here tonight and who have been here for the rest of your teachings, we want to thank you so much for coming. We rejoice in the fact that finally, after all these years, we accumulated the merit for you to return. Certainly those of us who have known you for a long time or short time or have just met you find you a tremendous inspiration. Your devotion to the Dharma and to keeping your vows in difference, you know, over the years is just so inspiring, and we just can't thank you for the wonderful example you set for so many people out around the world.
Thank you.
And we offer our sincere prayers for the success of all your activities. Mm-hmm. We know that Shravasti Abbey is quite dear to your heart, but everything else that you're doing also, we pray for its continued success. Mm-hmm. And we humbly request that you return to teach again.
Sure. I'll come back if you come back. Because it's a dependent arising, isn't it? Why should I come back if you don't come back? Yeah? So we all need to come back. We all need to participate to make this happen. Yeah? Thank you. Thanks, Ravi. And I brought... Where's my bag? Oh. Yeah. So, I brought with some of the mani pills from India. As I tell people, it's mani, not money. But mani, as in mani peme hung. And they're made out of herbal substances and relics, and then brought to the main temple. And the Sangha recites millions and millions of Om Mani Padme Hum to consecrate them. So I have them in little packets, and I have some sheets that describe how to take them. I don't think there's enough copies for everybody, but I'll give out what I have, and then maybe you can make copies. That's the spirit that's so nice in a Dharma center. You know, somebody that sees, we need this, I'll do it. Yeah, instead of we need this, you do it. But that's exactly the kind of thing that makes a center work really well, is when people have that kind of attitude. So, if people want to come, and then I can give you these. I always like to hand them out personally and make the connection with people.
Sa ji pe ki chu xing me song tam ri da bli ji ni de gen pa di song ye our sponsors, anonymous sponsor for Venerable Children's Travel. May all beings find an end to suffering. May we always find perfectly qualified, kind, and compassionate teachers who will lead us unerringly on the path. May we become enlightened and bear the responsibility of freeing all sentient beings. Jim and Cherry Satoris, we dedicate to the long, happy life of Geshe Gelug Choda and to the success and completion of all his future projects. We also wish that people everywhere have enough food and nourishment for their good health. And an anonymous last sponsor is anonymous also, for the benefit of all sentient beings. May they be free from suffering, have happiness always, and meet excellent teachers in their lifetime. And the prayer list, prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters, especially those at the Boston Marathon. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Ruth Appleby, Ron Burroughs, Claire Caruso, Frank Ferreira, Bill Johnson, Claudia Kunt, Sam Rainey, Mamie Stark, Chelsea the cat, Dakota the dog, Ivy the dog, Cook the cat, Shanti the dog. Job search, Kim Conway, Daniel Dimitrov. Prayers for health and well-being, Kyabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Venerable Margaret McAndrew, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, especially those at the Boston Marathon. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Jim Barnes, Roseanne Barona, Becky, Megan and Marianne Burke, Ron Burroughs' family, Victoria Easterday Clark, June Elliott, Guillermo Garcia and family, Gary Goldberg, Mildred Gooch, Scott Griffin and family, Ken and Annie Hassel, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson and Buddy, Bill Johnson's family, Helen Kasanoff, Meredith Kilmer, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Gary Marshall, Aaron Mervin and his family, Shelley Miller, Adrian Oliver, Jay Pandya, Jeff Peterson, Aunt Polly, Chuck and Faye Renard, Carl Rich, Scooby Rodriguez, Dr. Albert Sontz, Rosemary Cease, Dion Washington, Suzanne Williams, Kathy Wormser, Judith Wormser,
the Zeta Thai chapter of Pi Kappa Phi at Everett University. Loki the cat, Peter the dog. So we'll say some dedications in the prayer book. May all sentient beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion. To the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Alatade, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples. Please, please live long. Migme tsewe te chen chen de zik Dreamekempe Wampo Jampeyang Kanchenkepe Tsuken Tsongkhapa Lozang Dape Shabla soade Migme tsewe te chen chen reze Dime kempe wang po jampe yang Gan chen kepe tsu ken tsong kapa lo san jape shab la so ade mig me tse Tare tu re so ha
Om tare tu tare tu re so ha. 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 Om tare tu tare tu re so ha.